This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, you might have heard, you know, big headlines like Bitcoin's energy usage or crypto's energy usage uses more energy in a single year than the entire country of Argentina. One of the reasons is because the Ethereum blockchain uses something called proof of work. And now it is going to merge into something called proof of stake. If it's a little bit of jargon or perhaps a different language, we're really lucky to be joined by people who speak that language. Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Follow him on Twitter at Joel Weber Show. We also got Olga Karif with us. She's a crypto reporter for Bloomberg News. She has been covering the space for years and can explain exactly what is going on. She's joining us on the phone from Portland, Oregon. Olga's story is featured in the upcoming issue of Business Week magazine. You can read it now on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Joel, the merge has been a long time coming. Why do we need to care about it?
Will it come? It should come.
Yeah,
could come. Supposed to be like could come next, like tomorrow, 2 days, or the next right? day. Like we don't know. But
there's a countdown clock.
There is a countdown clock. Everybody's been very excited about this for a really long time. And one of the things that Olga points out here is really this foundational way that things happen on the Ethereum blockchain. And we're going to talk about that because I think it has some pretty big implications for especially that energy consumption you mentioned. So this proof of stake, Olga, I want to talk to you about what that really means, what it means for miners, and why should the normies out there care?
Sure. So it's a huge change. This kind of a change has never been attempted in the blockchain world before. And what it does is essentially until now and for the next day or so, miners, basically very powerful computers, are the ones ordering transactions on the Ethereum blockchain. And then after that, there will be a switch to proof of stake, essentially stakes of coins will be used to do the same, to order transactions. And of course, what this means for miners is that they will be out of the job, and miners have been looking around to see which other chains they could potentially move their equipment to or what other options they have. And for Ethereum, what this will mean is that power consumption of the blockchain will drop by about 99%, which is really good news for investors and developers who have been deterred from participating in the Ethereum ecosystem because of its high energy consumption. You know, companies and investors who have ESG requirements can now perhaps give Ethereum a second look.
So good time to buy a mining rig on the cheap, I guess, second hand.
Yes.
But what I'm fascinated with is the other innovation that this sort of unlocks, which is staking coins in return for a yield. You know, you lock up your Ether in a staking protocol and you get, say, I don't know, 3%, 4%, or 5%, whatever the yield is. Obviously, that makes Ether look a lot more like a security than just a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. And I wonder, how are you thinking about the regulators? Is there the potential for a backlash from the Gary Gensler's, the SEC chairman, and other regulators of the world?
Absolutely. This is an issue that a lot of people are thinking about and worrying about because about in 2018, a high up executive at the SEC essentially said, you know, Ethereum does not look like a security to us. And so that was the assumption to everybody ever since. But now Ethereum is undergoing some very dramatic changes. You know, right now people are going to be essentially staking, putting in money to earn yield. And that brings Ethereum just a little bit closer to adhering to at least one point of about four that regulators look at to determine if something is a security or not. There are also questions about does Ethereum become more or less decentralized after this change, which also impacts whether it will be defined as a security or not. So there could be some moves from regulators on this front. And in fact, in August, Coinbase, the U.S.'s biggest crypto exchange, did disclose that the SEC has asked for some information from it on its staking services, among other things. So, you know, this is definitely something that people are watching.
Okay, so this has never happened before. It's going to happen. If it doesn't go well, can you just put it in reverse and back up and, like, go back to the way it was before?
Well, so there are some people who are sort of creating alternatives and an alternative chain in hopes that the merge, the software upgrade does not go well, and then people will be like, wait a minute, we want to go back to the previous blockchain. So there are people who are creating a copy of Ethereum that will still use miners. But I think the majority of the Ethereum community is going ahead with this new proof-of-stake blockchain. It's been tested and retested for years. I mean, it's been expected to happen for years. The developers have been delaying and delaying because of this very extensive testing that they've performed. So they're hoping that the issues that do come up after this upgrade will be relatively minor.
Okay, and what does this all mean for Bitcoin? And there's this thing called the flippening.
Right. So some people believe that this puts Ethereum more head-to-head in competition with Bitcoin, which, of course, you know, crypto fans have long called digital gold. With Ethereum undergoing this transition, perhaps it's going to become more more attractive for corporate treasuries and for hedge funds and for other investors that have until now only invested in Bitcoin. So there is a potential for something that crypto fans called the flippening, which is basically the Ethereum market cap exceeding Bitcoins. And this is, you know, probably some time away from
yeah, even this not happening anytime soon, Olga, right?
Hey, right, absolutely.
And, you know, not much buying happening when it comes to crypto today. Bitcoin down more than 9.2%. Ethereum down close to 8%. Ouch. Check out Olga's article in the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine out later this week. Thanks to Joel Weber and Olga Karif from Bloomberg Businessweek. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, I might have spoke too soon because Twitter shares now are only up 0.7%. But on a day where everything is down, it is notable that something is in the green. The reason why? Well, shareholders approving billionaire Elon Musk's proposed $44 billion buyout. It paves the way for a trial next month to determine the disputed deal's fate. We've got Mandeep Singh right now. He's in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studios. He's senior tech industry analyst. Hey, Mandeep, you were joking that maybe this will mean that, you know, this will all come to an end pretty soon. And I kind of like said, you know, not so fast, because there's still quite a bit left to have happen before there is some sort of resolution to this. What is it?
Well, I mean, there could be another whistleblower. It could be, you know, anything from Twitter not handling their data properly, or they may have gotten breached, which they may not have reported. Look, I mean, we can come up with a lot of different scenarios, but at the end of the day, when it comes to how the court is going to view it, it's very clear that, you know, there will be a specific performance clause in the sense that if it goes to trial and Musk loses, he has to buy the company. He just can't get away with paying the termination fee. And I think that's critical. That is what will determine the odds of this closing. And that seemed to be increasing, you know, with the shareholders finally approving the deal.
Well, Bendy, what's kind of the vibe check on this case? I mean, from what I read, it doesn't strike me as the judge as being very friendly to Musk's case. I mean, is there any sort of settlement possibility, do you think? It's some, you know, between a complete forcing of him to take it over and just throwing the case out? I mean, where do you see this going?
Yeah, it's very unlikely given how the company's, has behaved in terms of dealing with Musk. And what they have said so far, it's very clear they want to force the deal to close. And the way the contract is structured, I think it really goes in their favor. And the whole, I think, whistleblower thing has created more noise. The judge hasn't really given it a lot of credence in terms of it influencing how this deal may fall apart. And I think that still remains. So I think the odds of the deal closing are fairly high given we've seen an approval.
Closing at what price, though?
Maybe there is a concession here on the company's part. They may, if they find, you know, their systems weren't perfect, you know, based on the whistleblower complaints, they may have to give a concession. But we are talking about maybe a dollar or two of concession, not material.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I mean, the company right now is valued at $32 billion by the public market. So you're actually saying that we could see Elon Musk being forced to pay more than $40 billion for this company?
Absolutely. And
that would be a bad deal for him. Just the only reason I say that is because, I mean, look what's happened to these types of stocks in the last few months.
It has, but, you know, I think when he signed the deal, he kind of knew that Twitter would take a while to, you know, really turn around in terms of, you know, coming up with a subscription model and all that. Why he changed his mind and why he doesn't want to, you know, buy the company anymore is beyond my wild guess.
We've all had buyer's remorse, right?
Yeah.
You know, like when I was a kid, I saved up for that new pair of shoes and, go buy it. And then I'd, you know, be like, oh, I shouldn't have bought these shoes.
But the fundamentals are impaired now from where, you know, he signed the contract and the employee morale is low. So a lot has changed for the worse, which is the reason why the company is so keen to close this deal, because they know they can't find an alternative buyer.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. What is the outlook for Twitter's business itself? You know, I'm looking at their financials here. They had a drop in revenue in the second quarter. Looks like another drop is expected in the third quarter, a drop in gross profit last quarter. They're kind of in decline. I mean, is this all part and parcel of just a sort of rudderless ship, or what's going on?
You're right about the management and the board not doing a great job of, you know, the fundamental performance. But at the same time, Twitter is a platform that still has the engagement. When you look at their daily active user base, it's still intact. They always had a monetization problem, and probably will take somebody more creative to really come up with a better model to monetize the time spent on Twitter. But look, I think the fundamentals are much poorer than they were back.
If they could monetize all the anger that site it creates in people.
I mean, the time I spent on Twitter, like, I should be. And you know what? The ads I see are so irrelevant. It's shocking to me that they haven't figured it out. I mean, they should know what I do. It's like, you know, I spend way too much time on that platform. Mandeep, we love it when you join us. You know, for the sake of us, we hope you get to continue to keep covering this story, because we love having you join us. Senior tech industry analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mandeep Singh.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Yeah, a lot of red there on the screen. Of course, today's equity market reaction, a response to what we saw when it came to, into those hotter than expected inflation numbers, that happening at 8:30 a.m. Well, a few hours before that, about 8 hours before that, John Authors from Bloomberg Opinion, a senior editor for Bloomberg Markets as well, wrote a column that said markets need a less rosy view of inflation news. He wrote that there's no sign of a Fed pivot or reason for Powell to make one until it's clear how to get back to 2%. John Authors joins us right now from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Follow him on Twitter at John Authors. John, like I said at the start of our show today, this was a really prescient column. You kind of called it. Also kind of gutsy to do this on CPI Tuesday. What did you see that perhaps a lot of people missed here?
Okay. I think, first of all, I did see quite a lot of... it's actually worse than I was expecting, because what I did buy into was the notion that that at least the peak was in, even if we weren't going to decrease inflation at anything like the rate that people were hoping. If you looked at all the numbers other than oil, there were still reasons for concern that inflation was still growing. And the other critical point is that, particularly in this country, gas prices work almost contrary to the rest of the index. So gas prices, because there's so little tax on gas in this country, in percentage terms, they vary far more than they do in other places. And obviously, Americans love their cars. And it turns out that if gas price goes up, they just spend more on gas and drive the same amount and spend less on everything else, and vice versa. So basically what we had in the last 2 months, which at least did help the headline number come down because gas is in the headline, was the effect, the equivalent of a tax cut. It's as though we've had Vladimir Putin more or less gave us the equivalent of a sharp tax hike followed by a tax cut. And that meant there was always a great risk, which is what happened, that the underlying products, the things that were separate from oil, would actually take off in a bigger way than we were thinking. And boy, did they ever. I mean, it was a very, very bad number compared to not only what the market was expecting, but to be honest, I was bearish about it, and it was worse than I was expecting.
John, I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball here, something that's not in your column today. Yes. But I have a feeling you'll hit this curveball.
You can move it to cricket and make it a googly or a leg googly. Break if you like. Yeah, carry on. Yes.
I'm thinking of you as a David Ortiz type here. You're going to slug
this. I have an Ortiz jersey that I do wear to go. Yeah, carry on.
But I was talking earlier about the whole notion of value versus growth.
Yes.
And you know how, lo and behold, we finally had this value outperformance earlier in the year. Many people tying it to this, you know, high inflation regime, good for energy companies, good for banks, higher yields, on and on and on. Then it looked like growth kind of made a comeback, and it was back to the old normal where growth was outperforming again, you know, your tech stocks, your high growth companies like that. Does today put value back in front for a while, do you think?
Of growth, yes. Momentum. The last time I checked, I did look at FTW, those listings at home, factors that work. FTW Go on the terminal is a really good way of seeing how the different factors are moving. The one that was strongest for today was momentum, which is simply because the momentum has generally been against the FANGs, and the FANGs have really sold off very bloodily, very impressively today. Yes, I do think it probably helps value at the margin. What people really didn't want to be holding value for would be stagflation. I think the chances of stagflation, as opposed to a recession that comes after the Fed has really had to bludgeon us all out of our resistance in a matter of many more months. I think stagflation looks less likely simply because the stag isn't happening.
Yeah.
And that is why the inflation is worse. That adds up to value continues to be a better deal than we thought, and growth continues to be a worse deal than we thought.
John, we only have 10 seconds left here. What does this all mean for the Fed and 75 versus 100 at the next meeting and beyond?
I would still bet on 75. The critical thing is how much they're going to cut by the end of next year.
Okay. That's what we'll keep an eye on. We have a little ways to go before we get there. A big thank you to John Author, senior editor for Bloomberg Markets, also a Bloomberg Opinion columnist with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Check out his story on Bloomberg.com and on the terminal.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit EY.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Mike, you were looking at the SINs function on the Bloomberg terminal, getting us some data about when the last time we saw drops like this in the market. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. That is actually on a closing basis, going from closing level to closing level. That's the worst drop since June of 2020, remember when the pandemic was still locking us all down. Even worse for the NASDAQ 100, though. Closing basis, biggest drop since March 16th, 2020. And I had forgotten how bad that day was, to be honest. 12% drop in the NASDAQ 100 that day. What a crazy time it was. But here we are having, 5.5% drop in the NASDAQ 100. Worst day since.
Hey, let's bring in Carol Schleif. She's Deputy Chief Investment Officer at BMO Family Office. Really pleased to have her this afternoon joining us on the phone from Minneapolis. Carol, how are you?
Oh, great. Great, other than
really?
The day, but
Are you really great?
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful fall day here, and we're getting lots of pretty sunsets thanks to all the smoke in the sky. But other than that, yeah, the market day is not such a nice day.
Okay, well, help us make sense of this. I mean, obviously, the equity traders got a little ahead of themselves when it came to thinking that the inflation numbers would come in softer. That didn't end up happening. What are you looking at today?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because we've been saying all along, we're range-bound, data-dependent through the summer. There's little to really do a compelling push to the top side or the downside necessarily. And keep in mind, we had migrated back towards the top of the channel. And so coming back like this, and honestly, this comes from the perspective, I know that the down days are scary, but I watched 1987 happen. That was 23% in a day, and the year still closed up. So
that's some good perspective.
I think a piece of this is, too, is that the market desperately wants to figure out a bullish tone, and they've been fighting the Fed all year. And the Fed's been unequivocal, saying we're going to, they communicated pretty clearly that it's a 0.75 basis point rise. And I think this number took everybody by surprise, but the data's been really sloppy month to month. And there are signs of slowing in some pockets. It's going to be tough to slow things like wages and rents because that takes time to work through the system. So the data is sloppy, and markets and investors hate sloppy and hate unknown.
You know, Carol, I keep thinking about, well, what could sort of break us out of this range that you describe, which I think is a great point to make. It's a very wide range, but certainly a range-bound market. And I keep thinking, well, earnings season is coming up in a few weeks, and it seems like so many people we talk to are skeptical of the earnings estimates out there. They believe that they need to come down to account for sort of the damage being done, the profit margins from inflation. So I'm wondering how you're thinking about that. Is the third quarter the earnings season where companies really sort of hit us over the head with some bad news?
Yeah, I think you could see a lot. You know, people will be listening very, very carefully to the earnings announcements. They won't be watching the numbers as much because numbers are a picture, a snapshot of what's already happened. So they're going to be listening really carefully for what are the inventories like. They'll be watching all the consumer goods companies for that. What's their pricing power like? You know, are there supply chain issues? Are there labor issues? What are they doing with their labor? They're going to be listening to all those indications. And, you know, it's too bad markets. When they get volatile like this, people tend to look only at the short term, because the intermediate to longer term, when you look at the U.S. economy relative to the global economies, there's a lot of potential strength underneath to prevent us from really tailing off deeply, because it's been a long time since we've had a Fed tightening cycle where you actually had the quantity of fiscal stimulus coming in behind it that we do by all of the spending packages. And we're spending on interesting industries in terms of green energy and infrastructure, and who knows, maybe a lot of those European manufacturing companies will decide that it's cheaper to put a manufacturing plant up here in the U.S. because they're closer to right. reliable energy sources.
Right, right. And we saw that Intel announcement in Ohio, maybe a sign of things to come. You know, Carol, I know that you and really a lot of investors who look at the market both bottoms up and tops down like to keep at least one eye on credit markets, especially in a rising rate environment like this. What are you seeing there in the credit markets? Are there any alarm bells going off?
I don't think there's alarm bells yet, but it's interesting watching the companies recently. You know, you've had not necessarily record corporate debt issuance, but a lot of corporate debt issuance, and a lot of people would have figured, gee, rates are up, companies aren't going to want to issue debt, but they are, because I think some of these companies think rates are going higher. And it's interesting because business, if the pandemic taught business anything, it's that you need to maximize your cash utilization, the cash on the balance sheet. You need to be really careful about what you're doing. So we're watching them closely. You know, they've been volatile. The yield curve has been kinky, if you will, and lumpy, because it's not necessarily inverted on the whole curve, but it's inverted in spots. So the yield curve doesn't even know what to make out of the data that we're getting.
Not that kind of kinky, Tim.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey.
Exactly.
Hey, watch it.
No.
Hey, Carol. Nice, Mike. I like that. Hey, Carol, talk to us a little bit about, you know, what you're doing with asset allocation right now. I mean, really, the question I have is today buying opportunity if you're long this market, if you're in it for the long haul?
I think, you know, it's interesting because we've been pretty cautious all year. We've been balanced, but we've had a somewhat underweight to more recently neutral weight in fixed income. We've migrated towards core fixed income because you can get paid to sit in some pretty interesting short to intermediate term fixed income opportunities. But we've been slightly neutral to overweight U.S. equities. Mid-caps have done pretty well in here. And we do think intermediate longer term, if you've got that viewpoint, it's an interesting standpoint. You don't want to be out of the markets, but I don't think I'd necessarily jump in with both feet because you still have some valuations. You've got earnings seasons right around the corner.
So there could be, you're essentially saying there could be further to fall.
Potentially. We just think you're range bound and you're not necessarily at the bottom end of that range yet. We don't think things are going to fall dramatically and not necessarily, you know, go into a big serious bear market or recession, and the Fed has a good shot at sticking a soft landing, if you will, although, you know, the inflation numbers would argue otherwise, but inflation numbers too are trailing for a lot of cases.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, other data that we could get this week. I like the idea that you've described the data as kind of lumpy and not really clear. Is the data that we're going to get later this week, PPI tomorrow, retail sales Thursday, University of Michigan sentiment on Friday, is that going to tell us a different story? Could it potentially change the narrative here?
It could a little bit, especially the sentiment survey, because consumer sentiment tends to be tied pretty closely to what we're all paying for gas. And so, and gas prices are down. That's helping a lot of individuals. Now, food is up, rent is up. They may say, you know, the rate of increase in rent is falling, but still, I know lots of individuals where they're being slammed with really high rent increases and they're trying to figure out changing up their housing situation. But you're seeing cooling there. You're seeing cooling at the fringes in other places. You're also seeing some straightening out of supply chains, which is helping all along the path there. Mm. You know, rails are moving, yeah. The ports are moving. And so you could change the narrative. I mean, today is really a disappointment about the narrative that people were hopeful that the Fed wouldn't. They keep saying the Fed's not going to have to raise as much as the Fed's saying it's going to raise.
Yeah, the narrative certainly shifted today. Hey, Carol, we got to run. Carol Schleif, Deputy Chief Investment Officer at BMO Family Office, on the phone from Minneapolis. Really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.